Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Rowan Conway. I'm Director of Innovation and Development here at the RSA. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to tonight's evening event, Towards Inclusive Growth. We're here today to mark 10 years exactly to the date since the run on the UK's Northern Rock Bank signalled the start of what was to become the global financial crisis. Today we're working with a global network of partner organisations to host a number of events here at the RSA this week to reflect a decade on from the crisis on three key questions. What are the lessons we've learned from the crash? Have we taken the necessary steps to reform our economic systems in response? And tonight's particular event looks at specifically at growth and inequality with the key question, how do we chart a path to a fairer future prosperity where the benefits of economic growth are more equitably shared? As part of this activity, many groups have been joining in by live stream to engage in the conversation. So I'd like to welcome everyone watching online on the live stream and remind you to tweet on the hashtag 10 years after, and a particular welcome to our fellow groups in both the Southwest and in Nottingham Civic Exchange, where they are hosting an RSA Watch. So, into the content. A decade after the global financial crisis, deep scars remain. Many argue that certain policy responses, such as extreme austerity, exacerbated the effects of the crisis, and when combined with the forces of globalization and technological change, have led to today's unstable and anxious economic outlook. Despite recent data signalling a closing of the income inequality gap between the highest and lowest earners, this has been accompanied by mounting economic insecurity, wage stagnation, and, particularly since Brexit, rising inflation. The shock of the financial crisis might have been weathered by buoyant employment, particularly at the low end of the labour market, but this too has been accompanied by rising in-work poverty, with recent research showing that 60% of households in poverty are in work, up from 50% in 2012. Recent political shocks have forced leaders to wake up to the fact that a fairer distribution of the benefits of economic growth is now an imperative. When citizens are left without a sense of a stake in national prosperity or with the feeling that their opportunity for social mobility is no longer realistically within their grasp, they soon question the legitimacy of those at the political wheel. So there's an emerging consensus that free markets are failing to deliver the trickle-down effect that was once so confidently assured. From the world's most powerful economic institutions to national governments, there's a growing awareness that a fundamental shift in approach is required if capitalism and liberal democracy are to continue to advance hand in hand. So tonight we're here to talk about inclusive growth. We're delighted to have gathered a distinguished panel of speakers this evening to share their reflections and analysis on the legacy of the crisis 10 years on. And we are assuming that Indy will arrive. But we're going to start with Gabriela Ramos, who is the OECD's Chief of Staff and Sherpa to the G20. Besides supporting the strategic agenda of the Secretary-General, Gabriela is responsible for the contributions of the organisation to the global agenda, including the G20 and the G7. She also leads the Inclusive Growth Initiative and the New Approaches to Economic Challenges programme, as well as overseeing work on education, employment and social affairs. So it's quite a big job. Previously, she served as head of the OECD office in Mexico and Latin America, coordinating several reports on Mexico to advance the health and education reform. She developed the OECD's Mexico Forum and edited and launched the Getting It Right flagship publication series. She will be followed by the Honourable Wayne Swan MP, who is the Federal Labour member for Lilly and former Deputy Prime Minister and Treasurer of Australia. In 2011, Wayne was named Euromoney's Finance Minister of the Year for his stewardship of Australia's finances and economic performance, both during and since the global financial crisis. Wayne is currently the chair of the Independent Advisory Group to the United Nations Economic and Social Commission for Asia and the Pacific and co-chair of the Inclusive Prosperity Commission at the Chifley Research Centre, I hope I pronounced that correctly, the think tank of the Australian Labour Party. Indy Johar, who will arrive, is an architect, co-founder of Zero Zero, a design, strategy and startup studio, a senior innovation associate with the Young Foundation and visiting professor at the University of Sheffield. Indy has co-founded multiple social ventures and he's co-founder of Dark Matter Laboratories, which aims to apply complex system science to urban and regional renewal. Indy was recently a member of the RSA Inclusive Growth Commission, An independent inquiry which reported earlier this year, which was designed to understand and identify practical, place-based ways to make local economies across the UK more inclusive and prosperous. So I think you agree we will have a true wealth of experience and global experience and insights to draw on this evening. So I'm going to ask Gabriella to kick us off. Specifically, Gabriella, like the RSA, and we've been very engaged in the inclusive growth agenda now for over a year, the OECD has identified inclusive growth as an agenda that speaks to our current economic and political outlook and seeks to redress imbalances and inequities that many would argue are created or potentially exacerbated by pure free market trickle-down policies. Now, these are the same policies that were at least partially responsible for the 2007-08 crash. However, some might say that the concept of inclusive growth is potentially a utopian oxymoron. How would you refute that view, and what are the practical steps we need to take to successfully implement this agenda, both regionally and nationally? Over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation, and it's a pleasure to join Minister, because I met him when he was a minister, and he was so gracious with the OECD. But I think the way you are framing the discussion is the right one, because we are talking about economic models, we are talking about economic rationality, and the way we inform policy. The OECD is known as the place of best practices, where we document and compare how countries deal with different challenges. But we have also been signaled as the neoliberal house, and we were part of those that had an unfettered faith in markets and the magic of markets to distribute, the magic of markets to tend to equilibrium, the magic of markets to decide on better allocation of resources. And I think that if you frame the debate in the sense of, is it linked, the increased inequalities, to the model of growth that also led us to the crisis, I would say definitely yes. It's not about only this question of framing the outcome of growth as just maximizing profits, and then if you need to distribute, you distribute later. And you remember it was always the case that you grow first, distribute later. Yes, inequality might be also an element to allow for higher rates of growth, and then you distribute. Or you grow first and you clean later. And you remember in the standard economic models, it's usually the case that the environment is treated as an externality, that you deal with it once you have acquired a higher level of growth. And I think that what the crisis showed is that this growth model has really failed us in those three elements. First, because we did not document the excesses of markets that led to the financial crisis. We did not really went into identifying the sources of inequality and how much they were growing, and I will get into that a little bit later. And of course, we did not documented the impact on the environment. So what has changed? What has changed is that instead of looking, as standard textbook will tell us, to look at the average and representative agents and long-term outcomes of growth, we started to look at the more granular dynamics of the economic growth in our member countries. And I'm talking about the most advanced economies. We started to look at household income instead of looking at GDP per capita. We started to look at investment in human capital. We started to look at regions. And then you really get a picture that is much more complex than what would have what the standard economics would have told you. And what we found is that as the imbalances in the financial markets were also rising and led to a very high concentration of the profits of growth to the top income of the distribution, the bottom 40% were left behind, completely behind. If you look at the distributional outcomes, considering the bottom 40% of the population in the OECD countries, they did not benefit at all from the expansionary period of the world economy before the crisis. And I think this is something that we need to have in mind, because it required us, welcome, it required us to look more granularly at the dynamics of our economies to understand what was really happening. And what was really happening is that the bottom 40% of our populations did not enjoy the benefits of growth. This bottom 40% did not see their wages grow. The bottom 40% did not invest in the human capital of their children. And the bottom 40% is those that we now characterize as a Rust Belt, or as those that are just expressing a very strong backlash against globalization and against global opening of markets. And I have to say that the OECD will continue to believe in open markets, but I think that we need to do something else when it gets into ensuring that the benefit of growth reach all the population. And so when you go more granular, we see that the income of the top 10% divided by the income of the bottom 10% grew 10 times in the last decade. It was 6 times on average in the 10 years ago, and is now 10 times. There you have a lot of differences, because you have the US, which is around 16 times. You have Norway, which is 7, still growing inequality, even in the Nordic countries, who have a very impressive social safety net. And then Mexico, my country, 25, and Brazil, 55, and South Africa, 100 times, which is... But the defining characteristics of this debate is that in all of them, inequality grew. Probably the only country that remained stable was France, and they're starting to grow, but of course they have their own challenges. This is income inequality. If you go to wealth inequality, it's 100 times in some countries. It's 70 times average. What does it mean? It means that there was a very unequal distribution of the gains of growth at the top of the income distribution. That was also related to the fact of this very innovative fever of financial markets, with instruments that, of course, only those that have some additional income can invest and put their money to some other use. The next derivative, because we really reject the notion that inequality would, in some sense, contribute to produce higher levels of growth, which was the economic thinking. Because, of course, if you are more talented, if you invest more, if you study more, if you work harder, there might be unequal outcomes. And that's fine. We are not going to look for equal outcomes for everybody, because it's true that some are more innovative than others. But what is very unfair is that the starting point, the opportunities, were also very unequally distributed. And then you have the bottom 40% that is lagging behind in terms of income distribution, but it's also lagging behind in terms of opportunities. And it's lagging behind in terms of access to good quality education. It's lagging behind in terms of the regional connections. It's lagging behind in terms of connecting to the most dynamic parts of the economy. And then if you think about the impressive technological change that our economies are also experiencing, the Internet of Things, the digital revolution, that then you really see how much they can be left behind. And we started also trying to link how much children from low-income families would be subject to receiving less quality education. And you know that the OECD is also the house of the PISA study, the Program for International Student Assessment. And we were looking at how much the bottom 40% were invest in the human capital of their children. Well, the reality is that if you live in those marginalized neighborhoods, or where schools are not the best, where teachers are not the best, the only thing that happens with some of the education systems in the OECD economies is not the same for everybody, because there are some that are more successful at using the education system as an equalizer. But in general, there is a reproduction of the socioeconomic disadvantages of certain income groups through the education they receive. That's one part, the quality of the education. The other part is, if you belong to a family whose parents only reach secondary education, you only have 25% chances of reaching high school, compared to 66% from children of a higher income group. So if you compound all these elements, what really led the OECD to conclude in the Inclusive Growth Initiative that we launched is not a social program, is linked to growth, is that inequality hinders growth. And that, I think, changed the terms of the conversation. If we look at how much you stop taking advantage, investing in the talent of your people, investing in the laggard regions, investing or giving access to credit to those SMEs that are just trying to survive, how much are you really losing as an economy? How much are you really losing as a productive economy? If you think about gender, which is another topic that is a good one in terms of explaining the missing contributions that women can make, it comes from 7% difference in the labor force participation of gender in Canada to 40% in my country, or I don't know, in the UK it must be around 10%. I don't know exactly what is the average. But again, by not giving the opportunity to those people to participate in the economy, to invest in their own skills, to invest in their own potential, then the economists really lose a lot of the drive. And this is what we call at the OECD the nexus. Because the old traditional economic thinking would always privilege the efficiency of markets. The efficiency became like the outcome of any policy decision. And then markets will operate their magic. And we forgot the other part, which was inclusiveness and equality. And as I said before, we used to say, let's just grow first, and when we will distribute later. How far are we getting into rephrasing the policy debate? I think that we're still falling short, because we're still looking, and because, of course, we are 10 years after the crisis, and we're starting to get ahead of we're still not yet at the level of growth that we had before the crisis. We're still 1%, 0.5% point below the trend we had before. So everybody is focusing on growth. But I think that we have the responsibility to reframe this growth paradigm and look at how do we give the tools, the incentives, and how we prioritize the infrastructure that these bottom 40% need to really contribute to the growth equation. I was very proud, and I will finish with this. Chancellor Merkel always invites the heads of the five, she calls them systemic international economic institutions, and the OECD is there, so we're very happy to be invited. You know, you're happy when you're invited, even if it's a restricted group. So they invite the IMF, they invite the World Bank, the WTO, ILO, and the OECD, and she asked, why is this kind of fashion and interest in inclusive growth? Every time I talk to somebody, they say inclusive. Why this happened? And then, of course, Secretary General Gurria said, well, it was the OECD because, you know, we documented all these inequalities, and of course. No? And then Christine Lagarde said, no. This is, it took a French to document it. It was Mr. Piketty. Okay. Mr. Piketty really gained a lot of highlights. And you know what? The ILO director, Guy Ryder, said, Mr. Merkel, the ILO has always been in this business of inclusiveness. But it was not until the OECD developed the business case that the conversation changed. I was like, oh, thank you. And I leave it there.
Fabulous, thank you. Thank you, Gabriella, for that insights into the kind of cold, dark rooms of power, geopolitical power. So we're going to move over to Wayne now, but thank Indy for arriving. And we have already introduced you, so you'll have to look on the when we play that back on the YouTube channel to see what I said about you. But we're going on to Wayne now. As I mentioned at the beginning, Wayne, you helped Australia to weather the storm of the financial crisis, and indeed throughout that time, Australia not only avoided falling into recession, but was the best performing of the world's developed market economies. What were the policies you pursued then to help you achieve that stability, and that you feel we still need to pursue now, 10 years on, to ensure that a more sustainable and resilient global economy where the fruits of growth are more widely shared?
Well, I think we learned a number of things during the global financial crisis, or the Great Recession, as it's known outside of Australia. We learnt that very powerful fiscal and monetary stimulus can avoid a Great Depression. And the deployment of that stimulus, particularly through the period late 2008-2009, did avoid a Great Depression Mark II. And we should be very clear about that, because there is a dividing line between those who believe that government has a role to intervene and protect their people when global demand falls off a cliff, and those who argue that really it's not the role of government to intervene in those circumstances and that laissez-faire should prevail. Now, of course, those economies that most effectively deployed fiscal and monetary policy stimulus did much better than those economies who either initially deployed stimulus and then withdrew it, namely the UK, or those economies that couldn't get a big enough package through given the magnitude of the challenges that they were facing, namely the United States. So the consequence in those economies where stimulus was either withdrawn with early austerity, or the consequence in the United States where stimulus was never big enough, there was much more capital and skill destruction in those economies and lost output for years and years and years after the London summit of 2009, when the coordinated response was put in place. Australia was one of only two advanced economies that avoided a recession, and it's now 28% bigger than it was at the end of 2007. The UK is 12%, the US is 15%, and Europe across the board is only 8%. The consequence has been that whilst we didn't experience a Great Depression Mark II, what the world saw for many years following the global financial crisis was weak and anemic growth. Weak and anemic growth, which reflected itself in higher levels of unemployment than there should have been, and certainly reflected itself in lower living standards. And of course, when living standards don't improve or people go backwards, then you get the political polarisation that we've been living with in recent years. You can see this most markedly in this next graph, which shows employment ratios across three countries, the US, Britain and Australia. And what that really demonstrates in that period, 2009, particularly through to 2014, is the scale of the destruction of the labour market in both the UK and America, and that Australia's very big and powerful intervention through fiscal stimulus protected our labour market, protected our employment participation, and has been a source of enduring strength for the Australian economy in all of the years that have followed. But it is very clear from that graph, even though you see a temporary correction in terms of the UK, that even now the US, with an unemployment rate 1% lower than the Australian unemployment rate, still has a lower employment participation rate. And that is a legacy of the high levels of unemployment, 8 and 9%, that prevailed in the United States for years and years and years, and have only started to be reduced recently. So what that graph demonstrates is that the Americans in particular, but the UK to some extent, waded through a vast swamp of economic disappointment for years and years, 2009, 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, where living standards for many people fell dramatically, which I think then brings us essentially to the point that Gabriella was making. What the global financial crisis or the Great Recession did was shine a very bright light on income inequality which had been emerging over 30 years, and the high levels of unemployment that then came with that cracked open even more widely the reduction in living standards which are felt by vast numbers of working people across many advanced economies. This is a very revealing graph. It only picks out seven or so advanced economies, but what it goes to is the core of the point that Gabriella was making before. What this shows is the income growth of the bottom 90% of the population across those seven countries. Two countries stand out as having done much better in terms of the growth in income of the bottom 90%, Australia and Sweden. Take a look at the United States. That tells you the nature of the rebellion that that produced Donald Trump. Take a look at the UK. That explains in many ways the nature of the rebellion that produced Brexit. Because over a long period of time, the growth and incomes of the bottom 90% were suppressed. And after the GFC, they were tragic in countries such as the UK and the United States. So what is it about those countries that have had stronger growth and essentially those countries that achieved stronger growth were those countries that had a fairer distribution of their national production across the great bulk of the working people in those countries. So what's a couple of lessons here? Well, we need the sort of policies that produce growth, which is spread more fairly across all of the population, not just those in the top 10% that Gabriella was talking about before. And what are those policies? Well, those policies are ones which recognise the importance of fiscal policy. Fiscal policy as a structural tool to deliver the growth and the fairness at the same time. Gabriella spoke before about the IMF and its conclusions that you grow more strongly if you grow more fairly. You grow more weakly if you are more unfair. And in a sense, that makes common sense, that you can't build a successful modern economy on a shrinking share of GDP going to working people over a 10 or 20 or 30 year period. That's the common sense of the IMF and OECD conclusions about the importance of inclusive growth. What are the policies that deliver that inclusive growth? Well, first of all, there are the distributional policies, the importance of a strongly progressive income tax system, the importance of universal health and education available to people across the board, the importance of fair retirement systems. But I would argue most strongly one of the key differences is pre-distribution. And one of the key explainers of why Australia in particular has done so much better in terms of the distribution of its income over time is our industrial relations systems, with a stronger minimum wage, a stronger commitment to a basic set of minimum conditions in the workforce. Unions, this is one lesson, unions are a very big empowerer and driver of inclusive growth. So if you want strong growth and inclusive growth, it requires a fair share of your national product going to labour, and that needs to be more fairly shared at the workplace level before we get to a whole host of redistributive policies that government should and must put in place to ensure that there is also intergenerational mobility. So all of these things are common sense, really, but can only be delivered if, in fact, there is concerted international cooperation. It can't just be delivered at the sovereign state level. For example, if you can't have strongly progressive tax systems unless there are international agreements to deliver abolition of rampant tax evasion by multinational companies, just one example. You can't deliver growth with equity unless trade is organised properly and fairly, and unless organisations like the ILO are taken seriously. You can't deliver inclusive growth if there's not global financial regulation which ensures that the financial system doesn't run off the rails. So I'll conclude where I began. Concerted international action did avert a Great Depression in Australia almost 10 years ago. I fear that if we were to be faced with a similar set of circumstances in a different way, that the political will for the sort of concerted action we saw almost 10 years ago wouldn't be there, because the campaign against the role of the state and the demonisation of deficit and debt around the world has reached such levels that it's almost impossible for many politicians to stump up for the hard decisions and the structural reforms that are required to deliver the inclusive growth that we're talking about today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wayne. There's some wonderful words going on here. I love the idea of a swamp of economic disappointment. Indy, so moving to the UK picture and maybe the global picture as well, it's been said that we let this crisis go to waste and squandered the opportunity for more radical systemic reform. So as a systems thinker, 10 years on, what are your reflections on the legacy of the crisis? And particularly as a member of the RSA's Inclusive Growth Commission, how do you rate the prospects of a movement for a more devolved and democratic approach to the creation and distribution, or even, as Wayne says, pre-distribution of economic value?
Great question. I feel a little bit like a fraud sitting on this table, but let me make a different type of contribution, I suppose. From my background, I suppose, what I would say is, let's start with two aspects. One at a dialogue level, which is, let's look at this. Every one of us sitting in this room, every one of us and everyone in London is more impressive than any general artificial intelligence that has ever been made or is likely to be made for the next 40 years. Just, I want you to remember this. You know, you hear all this about AIs and Watson. Well, every human being you've probably ever met is more impressive than Watson. Has more computational power, more contextual capability, more contextual intelligence than Watson will have, or equivalent will have, for the next 40 years. Why I want to say that is, I think our discourse has become locked and limited to the idea of a very impoverished idea of what it means to be human. And I think unless we can change the language with which we talk and see the human potential, I don't think we can unlock this conversation. This is not, in my perspective, about a 5 or 10% improvement of those at the bottom. I think the only way to actually build and deliver inclusive growth is to democratize the capacity to innovate. We have to democratize the capacity to innovate to drive inclusive growth. Democratizing innovation means you have to democratize voice, expression, care, creativity, and then innovation. And I think it's really important for us to look at this, because I think we're about to hit, in my view, what people aren't talking about, is we're almost living through an Ingalls pause 2.0, a 50-year pause of wages and lifestyles. And why we're hitting that is because I think we've hit the end of centralized control models of value creation. It's a much more systemic debate going on, which is that the way we create value is no longer possible through a managerial lens, a control-driven lens. So if you look at organizations like Teal organizations, I think there's a Dutch care provider, and I can't remember the Dutch name, so forgive me. I think it literally translates as neighborhood care, so if you do the translation. Now, this organization has 8,000 nurses, deals with 80,000 patients, has 80% of the neighborhood care provide, started in 2007. It has 25 people in headquarters. 25 people. Now, I think the future is about changing the way we actually organize much more substantively. And I think automation is going to bring that about, or has the possibility to bring that about. So I think the challenge for me is not about a redistribution of the managerial benefits. I think the managerial economy, I think, is coming to an end. And what we're witnessing is a post-managerial economy give birth. And I think, as we saw in the industrial age, the age where we saw industrial blight, I think we're about to see managerial blight. Because actually the cost and the infrastructure and the control capacity of management cannot deal with the complexity of innovation if we're going to drive it. Now, if we take that as an example, firstly, humans are more impressive than any AI that you've ever built, any AI, general artificial intelligence that's ever been built. Are we truly unlocking the full capacity of every human? And then the real deficit, and I think this is really well alluded to, the real deficit we're in the middle of is the deficit of unleashing of human capital. I think the real deficit every country should be talking about is how much human capital it wastes. the differential value of any human being here versus Elon Musk is nothing in IQ or capability or intrinsic capability. What we're talking about is contextual value and contextual ideology, contextual support. So at that moment in time, what we're talking about actually the massive destruction of human capital purposefully and consistently for a long period. Into that context, I think we have to then talk about what are some of the preconditions. And I think this isn't just for me about a technical response of driving growth or the benefits of growth. I think we have to actually talk about this notion of kind of almost a re-enfranchisement of democracy. Democracy is not the vote. Democracy is actually the power to create society. I'm borrowing Matthew Taylor's words, quote, TM. But it's really important. And if we want to do that, we have to build it up from these very, I'm going to repeat this quote because I think it's really important. We have to democratize voice, expression, care. In a complex world, unless you democratize care, you cannot actually build really powerful distributive innovation. We have to then democratize creativity and innovation. I think automation and distributed technologies give us the capacity to live quite a different economy. The question is, will we? Because 3D printing and 3D technologies and automation can also be a means of massive centralization, massive passive centralization, control. I think that's one of the key issues. Second thing is, in terms of what we talked about pretty significantly in the Inclusive Growth Commission, was actually other things like capital production. Our capital production is radically centralized. We have four or five major banks, they're all London-based, which means that actually what we did, and you know, in the 1980s when we centralized our banking infrastructure into the UK, what we destroyed was the distributed intelligence of capital production regionally. And in the process, destroyed our ability to make complex equations, which are, if you invest in a factory, you can also invest in the cafe and other supportive infrastructure. So now we evaluate everything on the merit of the thing rather than merit of the system it supports. And we don't finance the system, but we finance the product. By implication, what we've done is passively centralized and destroyed the capacity of our regional economies. So I think my contribution to this debate would be, how do we lift the capacity of what we imagine humans can achieve? And how do we lift it to the point that we're not talking about lifting the bottom a little bit higher, but actually how do we talk about lifting the capacity of humans as a whole? I think only then can we build a new inclusive politics, because right now we're in the middle of a divisive politics. With middle class wages largely stagnant or falling, we cannot build a new politic without actually talking about how do we lift the 99% massively. And that's got to be about really a new capacity development. And I think we have to talk about, as we invested into schools in the industrial age, we have to build the new human development capacity structures. And they won't be schools as we see them now. We have to build whole new institutional infrastructures to not only democratize capital, but knowledge and effectively agency all throughout the country in order to do that. And I think that's the only way we can start to unlock that. I'll end on this, which is, I think, you know, I'll bring an unfortunate word to the table, which is, I think Brexit has effectively meant that UK has voluntarily jumped off a cliff. And every other country is slowly sliding towards that cliff too. So I wouldn't worry about them either. Because the underlying structures that we're talking about are problematic everywhere. So the challenge for the UK right now is, how do we start to really radically release the human capital of 68 million people with a vision and which actually supports that? And I think by 2019, I think we'll be talking about a Marshall Plan type investment program in the UK to unlock our economy and really reboot it in a way that's possible. And I think we should start to think about it from that lens and think about the radical structural transformation required. With that, I'll end.
So there's three very, very different approaches, and I'm still pondering, is inclusive growth a utopian oxymoron? Through that, it's an interesting one. You, Wayne, you brought us the kind of importance of fiscal policy and actually really the consideration of investments in physical and human capital, and really, can we talk about, are the conditions there? So Indy talked about the preconditions for us to actually have debates about this. Are the conditions there to talk about progressive and tax systems and pre-distribution? Indy, you talked about redistribution of power and voice, and about, you know, the need to democratize voice, expression and care, and it's something quite radically different in terms of how we make decisions. And I'm interested, Gabriella, in that you raised, having described how you've kind of put the plan together for inclusive growth, a number of new approaches to economic challenges to really capitalize, if you like, on the potential magic of markets for good, if you like, and the varying other ways of redistribution or redistributive economic processes. Now, I'm going to start with that question of voice, I think, and I do think of your questions. There is a microphone, and so I'll see your hands, and we will come to questions from the audience shortly. But I'm going to start with a couple of questions. I think you were talking about Bertzorg, the organisation, the nursing organisation, and that is a radically different way of both finding voice and a network structure of decentralised management. We recently completed a report with the Joseph Rowntree Foundation that explored this idea of inclusive voice or a citizenship and inclusion. And there is a question about what are these structures, these Bertzorg-like structures, which help us to legitimately represent the voices of citizens in how we define policies, but not just policies, how we act, how we think about inclusive growth. You know, there's a question, might populism prove to be an effective means of giving citizens voice in the design of a new system? What are the tools for including people in inclusive growth? I'll start with you, Indy, but if you have any other contributions.
Yeah, I think the challenge I have with the frame is that I think we have to first recognize that we have delivered, I would say, is a form of economic violence on people. And I think the throwback that we're seeing is the effects of that economic violence. And unless I think if we really want to reboot this conversation for the UK, the healthiest place is to start with almost a peace and reconciliation narrative, to talk about a scale of actually recognition of the damage that we've done to other fellow human beings. I think it's a brave thing to say that. I feel like vulnerable saying that. But I think when I'm in the ground, in places like Birmingham and other places, that's what I feel. That's the level of disturbance I feel. And if we want to talk at the scale of actually building a new nation, we have to start by actually reconciling ourselves. So this is not just a small thing. I think it's a much more grander project in terms of actually rebuilding the respect and the interdependency at a nation state and with ourselves. So for me, that's one thing. And I think that's where I'd start. So this is not, the second part of this is actually also we have to acknowledge that our technocrats have lost control of language. So when people talk about markets, I can pretty much 90% of the time talk about free feudalism, right? I can pretty much write it out. I can just go, free markets, no, what they actually mean is free feudalism, right? Because markets are largely, you know, people have already discounted the fact of asymmetry of markets, so what they're saying is, well, markets will condensate to give money, power, and other things, so they've already accepted many things. So with the loss of these languages, and I think typically, so transfer pricing between Google search engine and its advertising business is there? Do we have transfer pricing between the two businesses? Like, I think we've lost control of these things. We imagine Facebook as a corporate when actually it's a global monopoly, and we treat it like a corporate. And we've lost control of our voice of description of that. And I would sit here and, you know, first challenge I'd say is, have our technocrats not been able to describe our reality because they've been insufficiently politically advanced to be able to do that? Most policies I see advance a free feudalism. They do not advance free markets. Free markets require the distribution of voice, access, knowledge, capacity, agency. I don't see any free markets. I see free feudalism.
Where would, sorry.
Sorry. So I would say, firstly, if you want to rebuild trust, we have to rebuild our language and our ability to describe our reality that we see. And I think people aren't stupid. I think people know this is going on. And so the major suck that we've seen is in managerial wages. The C-suite wage is where the real issue is. So the question is, the disproportion between the C-suite and effectively workers in the system has been where the real exploitation has been. So I think unless we really start to rebuild language and then also rebuild a genuine idea of how we describe our world and rebuild that ability to express or communicate that world, I don't think we have a chance. So for me, it's about really deep work, which is about a new peace and reconciliation commission. If I was standing here saying that, that's the stuff I would be talking about, is almost an economic peace and reconciliation narrative in the UK. Only then can we build a healthy political debate and a political understanding and actually a method to move forward at the scale of crisis that we see and the scale of violence people feel about their lives.
So I think, Wayne, you spoke a little bit to this as well when you talked around the demonisation of talking about deficits and debt structures. I think it's interesting to hear from your perspective in building progressive fiscal policy, how might you look to find sort of democratise the voice?
Well, I don't think there's a better time to win this debate than now. Trickle-down economics or neoliberalism, whatever you want to call it, is thoroughly discredited. You know, the notion that you solve all economic and human challenges through tax cuts for the rich, deregulation for the powerful, destruction of social security systems and wage suppression for everybody else is thoroughly discredited. So I think there is a hunger in the community for a much more informed discussion about the values and the policies that flow from those values, which will produce what we've talked about today as inclusive growth. You know, it's not beyond our wit to do this, notwithstanding the huge challenges that are coming from technology. I mean, post-World War II, under the threat of communism and the Cold War, Western countries did put together a thing called the welfare state that worked very well at producing economic growth on one hand and spreading its benefits across the broad populations of the Western world very well. Now, its destruction by trickle-down economics has brought us to where we are now. And we are now at a point where the rate of technological change is going to be so rapid that it's occurring at a time where there is also extreme political polarisation. It may be that we're going to go through a period not unlike the early 1900s following the Industrial Revolution, where the destruction of jobs through technology is going to be much greater than the jobs created that flow from it. And that could go for a short period of time, or it could endure for 20 or 30 years. But what it says to me is that we do need to have a re-evaluation of what role the state will play in filling the gap if we do have that massive dislocation that flows from the introduction of technology, which, by the way, I don't fear. The key from a public policy perspective is to harness the productivity that flows from that technology and spread it around the population. What that may well mean is a larger state, not necessarily a state which is full of all these public sector workers that work for Department A, B and C, but it may well require new methods of delivery of organisations working in the community in a different way, but ultimately funded by the product that has flowed from these revolutionary technologies, which if we don't have things in place like progressive taxation, will exacerbate the rampant wealth and income inequality in our community, thereby underlining why I think people will in those circumstances once again contemplate much more progressive tax systems, will hunger for unions in the workplace, not just having a role when it comes to bargaining, but being involved in the very administration of the companies that they work for. All of these are the sort of changes that will have to flow if we want to make sure that we don't end the way that the 1920s and 30s ended all those years ago.
So, Gabriella, I mean, it seems like the need for dialogue is ever greater. You described a kind of a closed meeting with senior leaders. I mean, how do we break out of that potentially managerialism and into a wider, more distributed by design way of engaging with people to define these economic systems to deal with the challenges?
Well, I think that what I have been hearing, I couldn't agree more. in some parts, not in everything, but in some parts, I think that the whole point is that probably we have been so engaged in creating profits and economic value. And we have had use as a proxy of progress GDP per capita. That's the growth rates. And the metrics are very important, because the metrics then focus the outcomes of the policies you developed. And what we are thinking at the OECD when rephrasing this question, and you can call it democratizing voice or giving social dialogue a chance, or is to listen to people. Listen to people and listen to what they care about. And that's what our traditional economic models have failed to capture. If you talk to people, you might find some that are faring not that bad, but they see that their neighbor is faring three times better. And therefore, they care about fairness. And fairness is a concept that has been completely neglected from the economic theory that has prevailed in the last decade. Trust, how you capture trust. You told about that. This is, I think, is the main casualty of the crisis. There's lack of trust. People don't trust the institutions. They don't trust international institutions. They don't trust the government. They don't trust because they have not delivered. It's very difficult. And the OECD tried to advance this question of capturing trust and going into subjective well-being. My God, I mean, the most well-known economists were looking at us like, what happened to these guys? I mean, they're losing the whole compass. Trust, subjective well-being, that's important. That's important. Don't decide for people. Ask them what they want and what they care about, because societies are heterogeneous. And some societies might put first, Mexico will put first security. That's the most important element for their societal survival. The UK will, I don't know, care about regional disparities. I don't know. You put it there. You just... And then what we're trying to do is to develop a framework of putting well-being of people at the center. And I invite you to go to the webpage of the OECD, because we didn't dare to tell people what they should care about. What we did by consulting with many of our countries and partner countries, also developing countries, is to define what would it be a multidimensional living standard? What would it be a well-being of people? And they get into 11 dimensions. Has to be with employment, has to do with social connections. How do you deal with that? Well, I think that healthy societies need healthy social connections that we might be losing also in our very rapid and complex societies. Jobs, health, education, security, all these things matter. And then we also went into another derivative. It's not only about jobs. Everybody would want to have a job, of course. You start with that. But you want a quality job. You want a job, and that comes with the social dialogue and with the level of unionization, because indeed you then listen to the issues that matter. And we're trying to develop a framework that will incorporate level of remuneration, risks of losing your job, and working conditions. And I think that will capture a little bit more what matters to people. It's more complex, and with me is William Hines, who is the head of the New Approaches to Economic Challenges unit in the OECD. And what we are saying is, like, let's not try to oversimplify everything to take the decisions. Life is complex, everything is very complex. I know that the digital economy is very promising if we manage it well. As everything, if you manage it well. Because the reality is that it's highly concentrated, competition is an issue, GAFA is just, and our expert on digital, he says that if Facebook was French, maybe he would have less problems. But the reality is that they are concentrating this. And if you think about it, data, the new currency of the world economy, who is the owner of data? And who is using those massive flows of data that we are creating with our interaction with the machines to feed the next generation of the artificial intelligence that will be owned by a very few set of companies? So There are lots of things, lots of issues to deal about, but the whole point, I will go back to what Wayne mentioned. Dennis Snauer is developing a concept, and actually it's very close to what you also said, the enabling state. Let's just, I mean, we went into the 30s, the crisis of the 30s gave rise to the welfare state, and I think it was a very good outcome. Now let's think about the enabling state, which is the other way to say what you're saying. How do we enable people? How do we ensure that people develop their full potential? Maybe utopia.
So the thought experiment for you to go home with will be, what would Facebook be like if it were French? So a question here, and then any other questions? We've got a time for probably three questions. So you now, do we have a lady who wants to ask a question to you, and the lady here? So there's one at the back, and then lady in the front, and then put your hands back up. Gentleman there, and maybe we'll get to you. We've got until up to 7:15. We also have another, there is another event in the series downstairs, so I don't, if we have turbulence, we'll try and avoid it.
So there's a very obvious, enormous challenge here, which is the power to change the system, to change markets, to make them more inclusive, to make them democratic, rests with those who have very little, if any, incentive to change because they've done extremely well out of the systems as they are. So how do we start to shift the balance of incentives and power to enable the system to be changed?
Good question. If I can take all of the questions, so we're going to you here.
Yes, hi. Hello. Yeah, I was very impressed with the views expressed in the first talk by Gabriela, and I'm just wondering if are these your personal views or they're shared, like these kind of radical anti-mainstream economics views? Are they shared by other people in your organization and the ones that convened under the German government, or they're just your personal views? And the second thing, I don't agree that neoliberalism has been discredited. For sure it has been discredited by unorthodox economists, by NGOs, but by far by policymakers, I really don't think it has been discredited. And the austerity policies that were implemented in many European countries clearly demonstrate that it hasn't been discredited.
Okay, thank you. I think I've got Gabriela's report, so the answer to that is yes. There's an OECD report that she wrote. It's not just your personal views, one hopes. The third question, gentleman there.
Thanks. That was really interesting. Thank you to each of the speakers. I find it's interesting that you're kind of speaking at sort of a national, supranational, and sort of innovative, organizational, entrepreneurial level. And it sounds like there's sort of a different way of approaching institutions. So it would be interesting to hear from each of your own backgrounds a sort of maybe critique of your own institutions. And I find states a very boring way of looking at things because everything's oriented around states. The way you measure data oftentimes reflected, but when you look at subnational and supranational, it's more, I find it a lot of challenges are usually at those levels. Mm-hmm. And I always feel like in these types of talks, there was been a few at the RSAs, that it needs to be acknowledged that although there's been an increasing degree of inequality in the last 10, 15, 20 years in rich countries, there's obviously been a massive decrease in absolute poverty in developing countries. And for all the weaknesses of neoliberalism, and I've worked for both Oxfam and the World Bank, you know, it's also brought around a lot of poverty eradication.
I'd say you managed to fit in about 18 questions there, but that's good. And the gentleman in front, I'm going to try and get, and we will then consolidate some of these questions into things we can rapidly answer.
So it was interesting, we just had the mention there of GDP per capita, because earlier when we had the graph of GDP and it showed the UK growing enormously, this was GDP in total, not per capita, because we've had a huge population growth. Now, it seems that the growth, most of the increase in the national cake in the last 20 years has been going towards the top 1%, and I don't know the exact figures, but a huge amount of that has gone towards tax havens and things, so you don't get the multiplier effect that you would expect to get with normal growth. It gets sucked out of the economy. Now, obvious way to change this, the RSA has been huge in this, is the citizens' income. you have higher taxes, and then part of that is shared amongst everyone. That will get spent locally. Any money gets spent locally, have a multiplier of 3-4 times, it gets spent again and again and again. And then also, no one needs to have schadenfreude about someone else doing badly, because everyone else who does well will contribute to the national cake for all of us. So for every super rich footballer, multi-million pound deal, we all get richer as a result of that. Now, can anyone tell me what's wrong with this picture? Why is not every single economist in the world arguing in favour of this, unless they're all just working on behalf of the people squirreling money away in tax havens?
Okay, citizens' income. I had images there of Paul Hollywood having the 1% of the gross national cake, but that's just an aside. So there are gigantic questions there, and we have about 8 minutes. So the first was around a shift of incentives from the wealthy, who will not, you know, will struggle to say, absolutely, I gift all of my hard-won wealth to ye, the wider populace. So let's talk about the shift. There was a question there around, you know, austerity policies have not been discredited, so discuss. I like the idea of, can we critique your own institutions from the view of the entrepreneur, the state, and the global institution? I don't know how long we have to look at that. And then the strengths of neoliberalism. And then a citizen's basic income. Who would like to start with which there?
Just on the first question, there's no doubt that inequality not only poisons society, but it empowers big money to take over and run politics. And that's why we're getting the outcomes we're getting. It's the power of big money. It's brute force being applied across democracies. And it devalues the whole principle of one vote, one value in a democracy. So a whole range of political reforms need to take place if we're going to break down the power of big money, which is responsible for putting in place the sort of regressive tax systems that are part of the problem. And really, at the end of the day, that's only going to come from a people's movement. It's only going to come from grassroots organisation. You don't win the battle of the ideas because your ideas are right. You win it because you marshal people behind it and they take political power. So I would say that I'm a Labor politician, but our party was formed to take on the plutocrats. And to have people out there with a machine and an organisation. And you will not beat the power of big money without the power of people at a grassroots level being organised. And I believe that's capable of being done. Secondly, yeah, it's true that this trickle-down hasn't been discredited everywhere, but it's in very bad odour. And we've got to kill it while it's down. So we've got a finishing off job to be done, but it's...
I think we
can do it. And then the point of being made about developed and developing economies, yes, it's true that millions have been lifted out of poverty, and that is a fantastic thing. But the problem that's going on in the developing world is that the patterns of inequality that have emerged in the developed world over the last 30 years are now happening in the developing world. And if they continue to do that, then the sustainable development goals will be simply a pipe dream. So the same battle that we're having in the developed world now needs to be fought in the developing world, because whilst the middle classes in Asia have done very well, what is the next stage of that development looks a lot like what's happened in the United States. So a very big problem there. On universal basic income, I don't agree with anything that you said about it. It is something that would be completely and utterly counterproductive. It would destroy the basis of a decent social security system, and it would not put a premium on contribution to society. I think it's a really dumb idea, I've got to say. And it's the sort of thing that people of goodwill come forward with because they're desperate for an alternative, but this is the wrong direction.
Welcome to the RSA.
I actually have to say that I agree with Wayne. but let me tell you, the core of the issue is that if you think of universal basic income, it leads you to the consensus view. There's no consensus view. I don't think there is a consensus view now. On the contrary, I think that we are trying to present the evidence to share knowledge and see how much we can advance with common solutions. But thank God there is not a consensus, because we've had a very strong consensus on how to manage the world economy, and it was one size fits all. And so it really depends, and I think the question on institutions is very important. because we just neglected the institutional setting in which policies are being taken place. And institutions matter in terms of course, government institutions, but also cultural institutions, social institutions, and the definitions really need to go down in terms of what country you are in and what problem you are facing. And we really need to get away from the one-size-fits-all that has been chasing us for so long. The question of decreasing poverty, I would invite you to take a look at what is the distribution of income in India and in China. No doubt, it's great that they have managed to lift so many people out of poverty, but it's just so skewed. Had nothing to do with the, in a countries that have no social safety net as developed as we have in the most advanced economies. So I think that there is a lot to be done there also in terms of continue to build a system that is more equal and more shared. Let me tell you then, one of the good outcomes, I think, in the international debate lately, there should be some highlights, I think, and some good outcomes of the international debate, is the work that we have done with the G20 and with the support of all the G20 members on addressing tax evasion and tax erosion. Tax evasion, of course, it was illegal, and we just went to get for automatic exchange of information and try to eliminate the basics of tax havens. But then you go into base erosion and profit shifting, which was not illegal. We allowed for companies to maximize and minimize their tax income. And so I think that these two elements, we have now 80 billion of additional revenue that the tax administrations are getting just by these agreements. And I think that if we just apply that money to redress the imbalances in terms of the inclusiveness that we need to achieve, I think that will help. The question of the political economy of reform, that's a hard one, because it's true that inequality is not only inequality of income, it's inequality of access, and access to the political system and to those that take the decisions. But we are an evidence-based organization, and we think that evidence might find a way. And I want just to share with you that I was 2 weeks ago presenting a report that we did, and that's probably some lessons to take on the telecommunications sector in Mexico. The public monopoly was transformed into a private monopoly that was just extracting fantastic rents. And it was impossible because the man who owns this is one of the richest men in the world, and he was just paying all the political campaigns. No matter what was the candidate, he will pay left, right, center, doesn't matter. He covered all the angles. And so you question, how are we going to break this monopoly? It's impossible. And we did a report just to answer the question, how much is the Mexican economy losing out of lack of competition in the telecommunications sector? And it was 2%. Could be 3, could be 1, could be 5, it doesn't matter. The model gave 2%. Legislators and the new president, Peña Nieto, could not stand with that. And they just grabbed the information and produced a fantastic reform that we just analyzed. Of course, the owner of the telecom company was not very happy. But you know what happened? It's amazing. 70% reduction of telecom prices in Mexico and 50 million new subscriptions out of 120 million Mexicans. I think the power of evidence might help us to break down this very difficult conundrum. Thank you.
Indy, would you like to close for us?
Thank you. I suppose I'm going to go back to language. I'm less interested right now in politicians, because I think what's more interesting is the Overton window to which politicians dance. And I think what's becoming very interesting for me is that the Overton window is what people like Nigel Farage moved over a period of time, and the politicians danced to the shifting of the Overton window. And why I want to say that is I think we've lost control of language for a while. And I think we've lost control of our ability to be critical about language. So here's an interesting way of looking at this problem. House prices. House prices in the UK have gone up pretty consistently. I assume everyone in this place, in this room, has a house. And you've gone up and exceeded in value. But say, let's as a working example. Now, in house prices, what's actually gone up in value? The house itself? No. The house is a depreciating asset, i.e. it takes money to repair and look after it. The physical land, well, even in agricultural terms, it's probably relatively nominal. So what's really gone up in value? What's gone up in value is access to common goods. So when everyone says location, 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 what they're really meaning is the rights of that location to parks, schools, transportation, job markets. So when you trade your house, what you're really trading is access to those rights and the utility of your house. Now, when house prices have gone up, what do you think has actually gone up? It's common goods that have gone up, to which house prices have artificially captured that value, because they're the proxy of that value. So in the UK, whilst we've suffered actual house prices increases, actually what's happened is common goods have gone up in value. Now, if we had the evidence and the language to describe this, it would be pretty fair to say that land value uplift should be a common good. It shouldn't come to individuals, because actually it's not your house that's gone up in value. Fair enough, if you add a room or you put solar panels on it, you've added to the material value of the house. That's completely different from actually the locational value. Now, unless we start to describe the reality to the world we operate, we cannot have a new politic or a new political discussion about how that value is shared. And my real problem is in that moment. And that also goes right back to the root of words like meritocracy, which people like Michael Young completely discredited as the illusion. The idea that your success is a product of you is actually a wonderful illusion. It's actually a massive product of your conditions and your context to which you grew up in. Now, unless we start to attack these conceptual frames, which are deeply buried casually and into our society and our ways of seeing, I don't think we can unpick this. It's also like the welfare state. We often talk about the welfare state as an overhead, as a tax. Actually, it's the primary investment for growth. The welfare framework provides the primary investment for growth. So we must be careful how we use language. We often say we've got to redistribute the benefits of growth to provide welfare. It's the other way around. We use welfare to create the infrastructure for growth. That's how it seemed in Norway, in other places. So how we frame the same conversations influences the politics we generate and the languages we frame. And I would say what's really gone wrong is the language and the framing has actually been polluted or corrupted. And that has allowed for a very particular politic to emerge. And the last thing I would say is actually we've had massive destruction of governance at every level. And our governance is absolutely broken. I would say we're close to corrupted. Now, I don't see any really good work going on future governance. Radical future governance. I was in Germany, I was talking to some of the major foundations, they were saying, you know, really don't look here. This is in Germany. And I think what new technologies are going to bring is radical conversations on new governance. For me, the issue is not about new government, but actually new models of distribution of governance. We need to rebuild governance in a method that allows for distributed innovation, creativity, and capability. And that requires a completely different frame. And so for me, I think the issue is language. We need to re-grab hold of language and how we describe our reality. I think we've lost control of that, and thereby we're seeing the political effects and the political policies that throw from that loss of language.
Thank you. So I think the role of the RSA is to take back control of language and host debate. We like to throw our Overton windows wide open. But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. It's been a nice feisty one. Thank you very much for that. But it is all we've got time for. But as I mentioned, this event is part of a wider series reflecting on 10 years since the crash. So keep checking the RSA and the 10 years after hashtag and websites for ongoing anniversary reflection, analysis and blog commentary. There's plenty of food for thought from this evening. And if you're hungry for more right now, the Durham Street Auditorium has still got events going on this evening. So the remaining events in the programme of talks organised by our partners at the Promoting Economic Pluralism Network, which isn't easy to say. There are still things to come this evening. Grab a ticket or a seat if you can. So, but for now, it's time to say goodbye. And please join me in thanking once again this evening's panel, Gabriella, Wayne and Indy.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.